don't you know? We're talking about a revolution. Sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour Possibilities. I'm Walt Keeson, your host, along with co-host Bill Westmiller, and you'll notice we have a new name this week. We're trying to move away from Surviving Meltdown. Not that that's not important anymore, because that's going to be continuing to be important for quite some time to come, I'm sure, but because we're trying to place a little bit more emphasis on the positive. I mean, news is always very negative, and we're always talking about the news, and we're just trying to find ways to make it more positive. So by calling it Possibilities, we're implying we're going to be not only talking about the news, but we're going to talk about how things could be if, you know, things were changed around a little bit. So, Bill, we're kind of taking a new step today, maybe a little bit exciting, maybe a little bit fun, but not so much fun for Argentina, because they're facing their own meltdown right about now.
We are progressing.
We're progressing, that's it. What's the
Argentina
radio
is
now?
Not. Argentina is regressing.
Yeah.
The Argentina has had their stock market crash the other day because their Supreme Court said that Argentina had to pay for the contracts that they confiscated. So when the Argentina defaulted and they tried to restructure their debt, a couple of companies in the U.S. demanded full payment, and Supreme Court said, yep, you can do that. So as a consequence, the entire stock market went haywire down in Argentina, which is now suffering from runaway inflation. So it's a messy business down there.
Now, do we have any sense what inflation rate they're currently dealing with? I mean, I know governments don't actually keep accurate records anymore, but, you know, just because it's one of those things we like to talk about.
I didn't look it up, but I just remember off the top of my head it was something in the neighborhood of 20% per year.
Yeah, that's an ouch. That'll eat up your income real fast.
Yeah, and it's been going on for like four or five years because of the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So it's... I don't know how many Argentine assets there are in the United States, but I guess the Supreme Court says, yeah, go ahead and seize them. If they don't pay their debts, then take their property. So if that's going to set the mode for other countries, like, say, Greece, or who knows what else is going to crash, the pigs, Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and I think Spain, are all on the verge of defaulting on their debt.
And correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't it the U.S. Supreme Court that blocked them? You were suggesting I thought that it was the Argentine Supreme Court, but I thought it was the U.S.
No, it's the U.S. Supreme Court.
It is,
said,
okay.
Yes, you can go ahead and seize Argentine assets if,
okay, all right. Yeah.
If they don't pay their debt.
Right, and in fact, I believe the president of Argentina referred to it as extortion for them to make that.
Yeah,
role.
Of course. You know, why should we pay our debts? You know, we should be able to, you know, just tell you guys keep shipping us what we want, and if we pay for it, that's fine. If we don't, tough.
Well, even more than that, it was an embarrassment for the president, because she has gotten elected promising to put in place and keep in place some essentially some social safety net programs for the people of Argentina. And it was her election was very popular. She won on I'm not quite sure if it qualifies as a landslide, but it was a very strong win. And essentially, the U.S. Supreme Court is basically saying, well, fine, you want to do that. You're just not going to do that getting away with not paying your debts. And that creates a tough situation for any government. I don't care what government you're talking about. Unless, of course, you're talking about the U.S. government, which has the Federal Reserve to print up all the money that it wants.
Yeah, I don't know why Argentina didn't just print up a quadrillion dollars and paid off the debt and fake money. Maybe it's a new president. I did read that she, you know, had good intentions from a libertarian perspective, but... you know, it just reneging on all of the debt, to dozens of companies, and this happened to be just one of them, in the U.S. that had been selling them all kinds of things, and they just said, okay, we're not going to pay.
Well, I think it's actually pretty clear why they didn't try to print up a bunch of phony money and just, you know, flood
because
market.
Because it just doesn't just affect the debts. It affects everything else in the whole country.
Yeah, especially when you're already at a 20% inflation rate. Because that's going to basically make something really bad much, much worse. And it's really very, very poignant to mention this because there is a major difference between the Argentine Central Bank and the U.S.'s Central Bank. And that one difference is the only thing that's really keeping a similar situation from happening here in the United States. And that is the fact that the U.S. still continues to be, or I should say the U.S. dollar, still continues to be a central world reserve currency. Once that role goes away, and that's the path we seem to be on, we're going to find it's going to be quite a different thing whenever they decide to start, you know, expanding the money supply to solve the latest and greatest crisis, because now all of a sudden it becomes much more difficult to bury the inflation. It's not possible.
Well,
you can play with the numbers all you want, but it makes it much more difficult because the markets can spot it a lot faster and react to it and basically punish you for it.
Well, it's basically a default when the Fed inflates. They're defaulting on all of their obligations to any foreign countries for oil or whatever it might be.
Right.
And the prospects that the U.S. is going to effectively default, if in slow motion, probably is making a lot of oil exporting countries very skittish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, the U.S. Treasury bonds, the reason why the Fed was buying $40 billion worth of U.S. Treasuries was because nobody else was buying them. And
yeah,
so they had to buy them to keep the rate low. Well, now they're stopping their purchases of that. And as a faith confidence in the U.S. Credit rating deteriorates, some of these other credit rating funds are going to start reducing the rating scores on U.S. Treasury bills. And that means the price is going to go up. That means it's going to cost the government more from their budget to pay that increased interest rate. So it's like the whole fake monetary system is going out with a whimper instead of a bang.
Which is typical. I mean, it's often the way that it tends to happen, but it's particularly true when your entire monetary system is debt-based, as opposed to just printing up the printing press, which is the way it was done, say, back in colonial times. But today they're much more sophisticated because they can create all these debt instruments and make it look like you're actually creating an asset, and that becomes the basis for creating more of these debt instruments, which creates more of an asset, which creates more debt instruments,
creates
more assets.
I mean, if the interest rates start going up, it isn't just the Treasury that's got a problem with paying off or selling their Treasury bonds. Most of the Dow 30 and S&P 500 are inflating their stock prices by borrowing money because they're supposedly the only creditworthy people for the banks to loan money to. And so the stock market is really hanging on the brink.
Mm-hmm.
If interest rates go up just a tiny bit, all this debt in the major corporations across the U.S. that they've been using, you know, with Fed reassurance, so to speak, are going to have a hard time meeting their own budgets. It isn't just going to affect the federal government. It'll affect every big corporation that's been borrowing money and buying back stock.
And yet they're going to continue to get away with it for quite some time because of that role that the dollar plays as a central reserve currency to the world. Take that role away, and the effects you're describing now start to come to the fore in a big way. But that's the one thing that prevents the whole shebang from falling apart. It's not going to last forever. I'm not saying that it will. I'm just saying that right now it's very obvious that the Fed, when they put out their latest inflation numbers, I mean, they're practically manufacturing these days.
Yeah.
They're using so many statistical game-playing tricks to make the inflation look lower than it really is. I mean, anybody who's been buying food and gasoline and all that knows. Now, prices are going up. Of course they are. But the latest report that it had gone up 0.4% over the last month, and this was considered a jump. Well, 0.4% over the course of the year is, what, 5%? You know,
yeah.
And that's, like, understating where it's been for quite some time. So clearly the Fed is quite capable of manipulating the reporting of the interest rate so long as the dollar remains a central reserve currency. And that's the thing. That's the one caveat. And once that caveat goes away, it's going to be quite a different story. But wouldn't it be something if we actually had a currency that wasn't controlled by governments and central banks? Like, for instance, something that couldn't easily be inflated. It would be an entirely different picture at that point, because if any of these governments tried to engage in any of these games, the punishment would be severe and immediate.
Yeah, turning the corner from gloom and doom.
Yeah, right.
Into progressing. We had a little chat about different alternatives to the federal monetary system.
We just like to go through a week without actually fighting with each other over something, you know?
Well, my prognosis on the good side is one of three different possibilities. If the money situation really gets disastrous, either we'll find states that under the Constitution are allowed to mint gold and silver coinage, and that coinage, from whatever state it might be, is going to become the new reserve for banks in the United States, and that they're going to suddenly be replacing the dollar, you know, per se, with a silver or gold-based currency. The second possibility is that one of the foreign governments decides that they are going to issue their own gold-backed currency. Germany and Italy and several other countries have been trying to get their gold back out of Fort Knox so they can use it to prop up their currency. Well, you can use Deutschmarks, or pounds from Britain in the U.S. as long as you've got a very efficient exchange rate established. So if you see signs that foreign currencies are going to become, you know, acceptable in normal commerce, I think that could very easily just cut the knees off of the Federal Reserve. So the third possibility, which I don't think Congress has the courage to do, would be to actually convert the dollar into specific quantity of gold and actually, you know, issue a, instead of $1, they issue a note that is good for 0.02 ounces of gold or 0.0, you know, 4 ounces of silver or whatever the ratio is. And we actually make an attempt to get back to a precious metal standard. I don't think any of those three are likely until you see Treasury bills, interest rates start bumping up, and you see corporations defaulting because of their debt.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen even then. I mean, even if the entire dollar collapses, I still don't think it'll happen, because history tells us whenever a government collapses a currency, they just replace it with another fiat currency, and everybody says, oh, well, everything's better now.
Well, it depends upon whether there's a credible alternative. I don't think that things like Bitcoin are credible alternatives, because they really have no value at all. The Congress or the Mint or a president by executive order, as he's inclined to do, decides, well, now a dollar is only worth one-tenth of a dollar, and we're going to start printing one-tenth dollar bills. I suppose people are going to buy that, but I don't see them.
I don't think they buy into that, because that obviously makes us something equivalent to what we used to call a banana republic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't see that being a politically viable way of doing it. I think they simply just do a currency substitution, brand new currency, all kinds of promises about, oh, we're going to preserve this one a whole lot better than we did the last one, and a very unfavorable dollar swap for new currency, whatever the new currency is called. Maybe it's called dollar.
That's the same thing as printing a dollar that's now worth a tenth of a dollar.
It's the same thing practically, but politically and emotionally it's different. And that's why I think they go that way. I'm not saying that there's any practical difference. Practically, it's still just stealing everybody's, you know, savings. They're just getting wiped out one way or another.
Doing it a different way.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking about various states, and Utah kind of took a step in that direction. They introduced a bill saying that gold and silver was legal tender if it was in the form of a U.S. Mint coin. The U.S. Mint doesn't print, you know, it doesn't emboss. dollar coins anymore, unless they do it for collection purposes and they mint silver dollar and gold dollar coins, which are stamped, and I think they're called eagles,
which people can buy.
Yeah, they can buy it, but they don't buy it for a dollar, obviously.
No.
You know, stamped a dollar, but it's, you know,
I think they're actually $0.99
silver.
I believe the gold eagle and the silver eagle are $5 coins ostensibly, but you're right, they don't actually get paid $5 for them.
Well, it would be interesting, though, if they actually switched over to eagle coins as an alternative currency.
I don't see it happening. I really don't.
Either. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do they do?
Well,
what should we anticipate is likely, you know,
I don't think the solution is going to come from government, because government has, no matter what level of government we're talking about, federal, state, local, you know, governments of other countries, parliamentary governments, doesn't make any difference, monarchies, I don't care what one you're talking about, none of them have an interest in a level steady money supply. They just don't, because they can't do all the spending they want to do with that kind of currency. The only way they can spend that way is through direct taxation, or, you know, to a certain extent through borrowing, but even borrowing gets limited because they can't cover their losses by printing up money. So I don't see any government ever getting involved in it. And there have been proposals that have been floated out there about, say, I can't remember what her name is, but somebody we actually had here on the show, she's published some very critical books and articles about the Federal Reserve and so forth, and she proposes the idea that the states should each issue their own currency, calling it the people's money. I'm not quite sure what she means by that phrase, but that's really a horrible solution, because she's not talking about issuing currency that's based on some limited commodity that, you know, you can't inflate. She's talking about just putting out as much currency as they want to, so you can float every single possible initiative that every state legislature wants to have. Well, that just creates the problem all over again. So again, I don't really see
instead
any
instead of one Fed, we're going to have 51 Fed.
Yeah, well, wouldn't that be fun? Be lively for a while, you know? I could just see you have the National Association of Reserve Banks. And they get together periodically, and they argue, and they talk about how they're going to control the interest rates, and meanwhile, everybody's savings is going up in smoke. But
yeah, you suggested the private mint was going to pop up that would be successful. The previous ones kind of either went into bankruptcy or got prosecuted for fraud or, you know,
oh, yeah,
a variety
and
of different.
And I don't mean to suggest that it's going to be an easy road, because it's not, because the Fed, the U.S. government and so forth in particular have very, very strong incentives to do everything they can to crack down on that kind of operation. I'm just trying to suggest that I think that if there's any way that a level currency can actually survive, it would have to be privately issued through a large organization of some kind, something where they can get the currency out there quickly into the hands of people, probably through some sort of a slight subterfuge, just kind of spinning on the top of my head here. Let's say a major internet company, a Facebook or a Google or somebody like that, or Amazon. Amazon might be a good opportunity. They decide to issue a currency for the purpose of making it easier for people to trade stuff that they buy on Amazon. You know, so somebody goes and buys a book on Amazon, then they want to rent it out to somebody else. So Amazon basically creates its little currency for that. So I could see something like that happening, and it becomes harder for the U.S. government to crack down on it, because Amazon is so visible, so large, has so much legal power on its side. Now, would Amazon actually issue, say, something that is gold or silver-based? I'm not willing to go that far. But what if a company like that could do something like that? What if they decided to issue something that was based on a limited commodity? That strikes me as being the most possible scenario.
Well, green stamps were very widely accepted 30 years ago, 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they were valuable, you know, as cash, and they could be used to purchase all kinds of things in nearly every store that honored green stamps, which is a very large circuit, a very large assortment of businesses. But I haven't seen a green stamp in like 5 years, 10 years, something like that.
Oh, more than that. I'd say green stamps have been gone for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But green stamps were also never based on a limited commodity. They're based on the dollar, which is hardly a limited commodity.
True.
Not even close. But you're right. I mean, there is an example of how a company can potentially issue something that becomes, you know, something that kind of trades like money and it gets used by the population. I think that kind of approach is going to ultimately be the one that has the best chance of succeeding. Will it happen? I don't know, but I'd have to say the odds are against it.
So hearkening back to our surviving meltdown, so what advice do you give for people that want to avoid the consequences of whatever disaster is going to strike the monetary system?
First piece of advice, start stomping and stamping and standing on platforms and shouting for the rooftops, we want a level, steady money supply. I mean, honestly, that's the best way to get attention for something that is going to produce the kind of results you're looking for. When people are ignoring the monetary system, most people don't even understand how the darn thing works, you know, so it doesn't get any attention. But if people actually start paying attention, saying, look, we want money that actually holds its value. Well, you know, if enough people start saying that, maybe somebody starts paying attention somewhere. Maybe I suppose it could be a politician, but I don't really believe that. But, you know, maybe some corporation comes along or maybe some joint venture comes along and they say, you know what, maybe there's a little profit potential here. I wonder if we can explore it.
Well, maybe,
the government actually starts get some religion and starts thinking logically. I just don't believe that's going to happen.
maybe Paul Krugman will go to see the third installment of Atlas Shrugged and have a Jesus moment.
Not really into Greenland, I tell you.
I think Atlas Shrugged is coming out in September, so it's getting a lot of publicity.
I wouldn't even want to associate Atlas Shrugged with what I'm talking about. I mean, Grant had some good ideas, but she was all, let's be perfectly honest, Ayn Rand was psychotic.
Maybe we can discuss that on another game. What's our second topic? We can overlap the...
another topic for another time. But but she really was psychotic. Trust me.
I disagree, but we'll leave that.
Oh, well, then that's going to be a fun topic sometime.
Sure.
Because we love it whenever we disagree. And for some reason, the listenership keeps going up whenever we disagree, so we got to look for more stuff to disagree about.
No, that's not true.
No?
I'm just being disagreeable.
So let's see. What else is happening in the world of monetary systems? Well, we've got some older articles that we haven't touched on that we've just been kind of carrying along here, but the percentage of workers in the workforce as a percentage of the overall population. Now, that's something that you found an article on, and it's in a trend that's been ongoing for quite some time. But I believe the headline you found was that it's now at a 36-year low, and that's more significant than most people realize.
Yeah, 37% of employable people are no longer looking for jobs, or at least they're not filling out the paperwork for unemployment insurance. Now, the unemployment insurance, remember, died out. They had it up to 99 months for a while. And as part of the budget deal, they canned it, and now it's back to, I don't recall whether it's 1 year or 18 months, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever the employment numbers come out, I'm, you know, astounded that they can still get away with, although most of the news stories mention the fact that the reason why the inflation rate is low, not that 5.5% is low, it's high compared with the previous history, but most of the news stories do mention that is only the relationship between the people who have filed with the government saying they're out of work and they're looking for work, and they're either getting unemployment insurance or they're continuing to go down to the Bureau of Labor offices, employment offices, and report that they're still looking for a job. So with 37% of the eligible, you know, employees not even looking anymore, moving in with their parents or grandparents or something, it's a total distortion of the market. I mean, any time an economy loses 37% of their workers, that's got to be a huge, huge disaster for the entire economy.
Oh, yeah, because it's not like there's never enough work to be done. It's just that the distortions in the economy prevent companies from being able to be in a position where they can afford to hire workers. But there's plenty of stuff that needs to be done at all times.
Sure. And there's all kinds of opportunities for innovation and new products and competition, but people aren't doing it because of the monetary situation primarily.
Yeah.
You know, small businesses are taking the brunt of it while the big businesses are getting by. So we've got, you know, corporatism with a vengeance. It's having a huge effect on the employment market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially the very, very largest corps and the very largest banks, they clean up on it. But the other thought that occurs to me is that with the loss of all these employees, and you mentioned how people are now living with their parents and so forth in larger numbers than ever before. I actually ran into a very interesting example of that. In my own business, I've been hiring telemarketers lately. And I know telemarketers, people hate that, but don't worry, I'm calling businesses, I'm not calling consumers. That's another subject, but the point is I hired one telemarketer who currently is 45 years old, living with his parents, and uninsured. How's that for a combination? And I wonder how common it is, to be honest. I wonder how common it is.
People keep to themselves, so you don't hear about it, and they aren't kind of the kind of people that are going to be participating in surveys or anything like that.
But if a third of the population that could be in the labor force is no longer in the labor force, it's got to be fairly common to have just that kind of scenario going on, where people who should be, by typical measures, should be out there earning their own way, living in their own homes and so forth, they're still living home with mom and dad, and even though mom and dad are now in their 60s or 70s and, you know, basically just trying to get by because they can't get work.
Yeah,
and
you know, if you look at various welfare programs, there are more people on food stamps now than in the history of the country since the food stamp program was started. People are sitting at home with their parents and playing online poker or whatever, and getting food stamps every month. You know, when you provide a benefit and incentive for people not to work. Guess what? They don't work.
Well, but let's qualify that for a bit, because I actually know people who are on food stamps, and I know from their own experience that they would dispute a great deal about what you had to say there. For instance, they're not sitting at home playing poker. In fact, in many, many states where you can get food stamps, of course you can get food stamps in all 50, but in many states, people who are on food stamps, they actually spend so much time interacting with the government in order to keep their food stamps, in order to keep whatever welfare benefits they're getting, they barely even have time to go look for jobs. The regulations that are involved in this, all aimed at the idea of getting these people off the social, off the safety net, have essentially made it impossible for them to get off the safety net, which is really sad. That's a really terrible thing. But, it's really what happened.
But it's psychologically, I mean, people who are in that kind of position, are not using their talents, are not being creative, are not being productive, are not doing anything with their lives. They're basically, you know, feeding off the government.
That's not necessarily true. See, this is one of the things that perhaps separates me from other libertarians. But I just from having known people who have been in that situation. I know some right now who are in that situation. I know of a few who are actually facing homelessness. And it's not because they're unwilling to work. It's not because they don't have any talent. It's because they can't get anybody to hire them. I mean, I swear to God, I can think of off the top of my head four people who are pretty close to me who right now can't get work. They literally can't.
Yeah.
And there are a number of reasons why it's true. One of the most common ones is because they're women. They're older women, and quite frankly, older women are just because of the way the economy tends to work and the way employers tend to work, they don't have as good a chance of getting jobs, especially if they live in the so-called red states.
No, I mean, that's true. But what I'm saying is that because there aren't jobs out there and because people have become dependent on government, psychologically, their lives are not optimistic. Their lives are mundane and boring and trivial, and that's a huge loss for the economy.
I wouldn't even agree with that. It's not that their lives are mundane, boring, and trivial, because the ones I'm thinking about, their lives aren't mundane, boring, and trivial. Their lives are stress-filled. Their lives are, oh, my God, how am I going to get through the week? So I wouldn't call that trivial, and I wouldn't call that, you know, just bored, because that's not the case. It's not like they're sitting around their butts.
Yeah,
they're out there trying to do things.
But if there's 37% of the working age population that are in that predicament, in depression, the consequences of that psychologically for the whole country, for all social interaction in the country, is disastrous.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. That is beyond doubt. And that's probably the biggest legacy of monetary system. Now, people might be wondering, what's the connection between unemployment and monetary system? Maybe we should
tell us after the break.
Oh my God, we're halfway through this show already. We haven't even gotten to the possibilities part. Oh well, we'll have to do that after the break. This is the Freedom News Hour, Possibilities, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Okay, we're back here on the Freedom News.
Tables are starting to turn. Which way would you like them to turn?
Well, I hope they turn toward you know, some possibilities, towards some, I don't know, dare I say it, prosperity. That would be good, wouldn't it?
So what do people do? Self-employment? I hear there's good money in standing out in parking lots with a cardboard sign.
Yeah, there have been some stories about that, too. Yeah.
So you wanted to be progressive. So what's the progressive response?
Well, I'm not sure if I want to be progressive. What I want to do, though, is touch on what the possibilities are. And what,
okay.
What the
Go for it.
In order to have possibilities, of course, we have to change the scenario, because the current scenario can't lead to good possibilities. I mean, that's just the nature of a bad monetary system, a bad approach to doing stuff. But what if we change the scenario around? What if we somehow have a level steady money supply? Well, now all kinds of possibilities open up, because unlike under a money supply that's constantly increasing in size, and where essentially all the value is being stolen from virtually everybody in order to make the rich richer and the politicians richer, they're getting to actually keep the money that they earn. They're actually able to save some money. And when people can save money, that's when all the micro enterprises start to, you know, appear out of nowhere. There are people who are creating micro enterprises even now, just in much smaller numbers than they normally would. You see them all the time on the internet. Anybody who's spent any time looking at what's going on the internet, you see these things happen all the time. But imagine if everybody was able to share in it, because, you know, they're able to put some money aside because they know, among other things, the money's actually going to have value next week.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's good. You know, that's optimistic. Except, how do you change the monetary system? You have to get Congress, a majority in Congress, and a president that are willing to, you know, modify the monetary system.
Well, that's one slow slog. that's one way. The other way, as we talked about, was to create a private initiative. I think the real point, though, is assume that we can. I mean, sure, we don't have. Do we have all the answers on how to make that happen tomorrow? No, of course not, because all the forces are arrayed against it. But that doesn't mean it has to stay that way. So let's assume that it does change one way or another. I don't care which way. Let's just assume that we do manage to get a money supply that doesn't inflate like crazy. Well, once we start getting that, then we have possibilities. Then things can happen. Then we can actually have growth, prosperity. We can actually, can you imagine we could actually have a day where people didn't have to work 40, 50, 60-hour weeks in order to survive? Wouldn't that be a nice change?
Well, the other alternative in the meantime is to invent a better bullet so you can get into part of the military-industrial complex.
I hope that's tongue-in-cheek.
Well, it's a lead into the other story we had about two different companies that sued the defense department because they had a monopoly on, I think it was Boeing, had a monopoly on the launch vehicles. And so SpaceX, which is a private enterprise, and another one called Palantir, were shut out of the bidding on these contracts for launching satellites, military satellites. And as a consequence, they've been shut out of all of the government contracting So I guess the rule is if you're going to play the defense game, you don't sue your customer in order to participate. But just invent a better bullet.
Business sense. Yeah, that's probably good advice. So anybody who wants to go into business, make sure you don't antagonize your customer. Very good advice. I like it.
But, the military-industrial complex is trying so hard to keep wars going so that they can export bullets and blow things up and provide consumables and new equipment and drones and who knows what kind of armored vehicles. That's what the defense industry thrives on. And so we now have another pending ominous war in Iraq.
Yeah, Iraq is a funny situation, and I say that literally. It is funny, not that it's funny to have war, not that it's funny that Iraq is falling into essentially this civil war situation, basically, I don't know what the word is, but falling apart in front of our eyes. But the funny part is what the Republicans are saying about it here in this country. And the reason I say it's funny is this is actually one time where I'm mildly, in a tiny, tiny way, sympathetic to President Obama. Because the Republicans are saying that it's Obama who is basically withdrawing from Iraq and who has basically set up this scenario whereby Iraq collapses upon itself. And the reason I say it's funny is it wasn't President Obama who ordered that. It was President George Bush who ordered that.
Are
you kidding me, guys?
You hear some Obama defenders saying, well, Obama got us out of Iraq. It was he was the one that decided to pull out the troops. No. George Bush, A, got us in, but B, also failed to get an agreement for the troops to stay. And so that was why they had to evacuate.
Yeah.
It was Bush that vetoed any prospect of dividing up Iraq, which really should be three different countries. Kurdistan area and the Sunni area and the Shiite area, and he just said, no, we can't have that. We have to have, all the centralized power. We can't change borders. The UN is going to get all confused because there are three countries there instead of one. And so what's happening is they're now Obama is trying to find an avenue for doing enough to keep the defense industry happy and not doing so much that we get troops back into Iraq that are getting killed. He's putting boots on the ground. It's something like 250, American soldiers going in. Supposedly, you need 250 more soldiers, to defend the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the claim. But what the news is always, you're right, Fox and so on, it's all Obama's fault that Iraq is falling apart. It's got nothing to do with anything Obama did.
No.
It's all what George Bush did. And although Obama is saying, look, I can do anything I want to. If I want to send in troops, I want to send in airplanes and blow the hell out of it, I can do that. Because the authorization for the use of force in Iraq, which is what George Bush asked for, is still in effect.
Yeah, it was never rescinded.
And so he can go and do anything he damn well pleases, but he doesn't really want to get another war going there. But nevertheless, there's a civil war. Now, what a lot of the news commentary tends to ignore is this is all religious warfare.
Mm-hmm.
This is all Sunnis versus Shiites, with a few others thrown in here and there. So the Sunnis are basically all from Saudi Arabia, and they want to have control of Iraq. And they did have control when Saddam Hussein was in power.
Right.
You overthrow Saddam Hussein, and now all the Shiites in the south are more populous than the Sunnis in the west. And so when they have an election, guess who gets elected? A Shiite.
That's right.
So Maliki is a Shiite, and then you get all this mess in Syria, and the Sunnis go into Syria, and the Shiites go into Syria. They fight it out for a while. So apparently now, it's the Shiites that are winning to keep Assad in power, and therefore the Sunnis are all coming back into Iraq, and they want to take over Iraq. So it just, it's two religious groups that have been fighting in that area for the past millennia, 1,000 years. And they aren't going to stop tomorrow. So it puts the U.S. in a very odd predicament. And as far as I can tell, the only interest we have there at all is oil.
Right.
But we get oil from Saudi Arabia and Qatar and from Iraq and from, you know, all these other Arab states. So they're trying to protect the oil companies' investments in the oil fields in Iraq. And they've been doing that for too many decades.
And they've been doing it with too much failure. That's the other part.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
The thing that we all overlook is the fact that the only reason Iraq is currently in the situation it's in is because the U.S. wanted to knock strongman Saddam Hussein out of power because he wasn't towing the CIA line.
He wasn't towing the CIA line, but the Sunnis were not a majority. So if you're a Democrat, I mean, how can you be in favor of a dictator who's representing only a minority, which happens to be Sunni?
Okay, well, either way you look at it, the point is that we interfered. We interfered
for
changing the regime around to something we thought would be better. And look at the result. The result's an absolute disaster.
It made
the situation far worse. I mean, before, the one thing you can say about Hussein, and there's a lot of bad things to say about him, but one good thing you can say about Hussein was there was no al-Qaeda in Iraq while he was in control. Now al-Qaeda is all over Iraq.
Yeah.
And they're infiltrating both sides. They're playing both the Shias and the Sunnis and essentially gaining more and more foothold by the day.
So essentially
the whole goal was to create a more secure Middle East by knocking Saddam Hussein out of power. And what they produce is a vastly less secure Middle East, basically working against what they were trying to do, which was to protect, like you say, the oil interests. Well, it's not working out too well, is it, guys?
Yeah, and under Bush Cheney, when Saddam was overthrown, the U.S. tried to write a constitution for Iraq.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, you can't split it up. It's got to be a federal system, and it has to be total control over all the Iraq territory. And here's the constitution we recommend. Mm. They did not give them the U.S. constitution. They gave them a laundry list of all the different special privileges and Sharia law and this, that, and another thing, basically written by bureaucrats in D.C. for the ideal socialist state. And the Iraqis said, no. We have to throw in the Shia, Sharia law because the Shiites are the majority, and so we have to have, you know, laws that conform with their religious beliefs. And so it just became an utter, disastrous mess. So it's a little bit humorous when Obama says the only solution to this conflict is political. It's very ironic.
Mm-hmm.
After George Bush's failure to come to any political agreement about U.S. troops there or about what the objective was for a new Iraqi government, a total disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably most frustrating for all the people who, whose sons and daughters went to Iraq to depose Hussein and spent, 5 years there to accomplish nothing. They didn't eliminate the civil war. They didn't eliminate the sectarian strife. They didn't eliminate the Shiite and Sunni conflicts. Basically accomplished nothing. For a short period of time, it gave the U.S. Oil companies a slight, very slight, almost inconsequential increase in the oil coming in from Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all it did for a very short period of time.
Yeah, that's true. Well, let's see. We've got about 15 minutes left. Why don't we shift to another topic? We've got, we talked quite a bit about Obamacare lately. What's going on in the world of politics? Because we really haven't heard anything yet. Do we have anything really new going on?
The new thing is that the Cantor, the majority leader of Republicans, got totally wiped out in the primary election.
Yeah.
And so he's had to resign, and today they elected his replacement and a new majority whip. And I don't know how to read it. Kevin McCarthy is the guy who's going to replace Cantor. There was a fellow by the name of Labrador who was kind of a Tea Party type running against him, and there were several votes, but McCarthy ended up winning the majority role in the House of Representatives. So I don't know exactly what comes of it, but it's an interesting new configuration, and so it's kind of up in the air as to which way the party is going to go. And McCarthy is somewhat of a compromiser, and he's interested in finding things that Republicans can actually do and accomplish rather than just opposing Obamacare or whatever new regulations are being proposed by Obama.
Well, from what I hear, the people who got elected into these power positions were all basically close to Boehner, the Speaker. So I think it's safe to say you're not going to see any tremendous change. You're not going to see the Republicans wising up and realizing they've got to reach out to a different constituency. I think you're going to see the same old social conservatism and all that kind of stuff. We'll have to wait and see how it plays out, but I can't honestly say I see any real significant change happening here.
No, I mean, the thing that everybody notes is it's still a Chamber of Commerce leadership. It's still a corporate state.
Yep.
It's still Republicans as well as Democrats, depending upon which industry you're talking about and what they're doing, using special favors in order to benefit corporate interests or labor interests or nonprofit interests or whatever it is. So both parties are still being run by corporatist elites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. One thing that occurs to me, though, as you look at the political picture is, we talked earlier about how it'd be great if the government decided to engage in some sort of change of the currency, put it, tie it into gold or something like that. And you look at the actions that are taken just today with this change in leadership in the Republican Party. It's pretty clear they're not ever going to get to the point where they're going to adopt a currency like that. They're never going to move to a currency that's actually good for the American people. They're tied to corporate interests. It's just not going to happen. I wish it would.
Yeah. No, it's very uncertain future.
It's a certain future, and we're trying to avoid the disastrous consequences of that certain future.
Although I don't know. I think, if we're going to talk about optimism or looking forward to solutions, I think you're correct. If people start recognizing what's going on and the corporatist environment and actually cast votes against the establishment and cast votes against incumbents, it could be a big change politically. And that's a nice lead up to the 2016 presidential race, which may be between Rand Paul and Hillary Clinton.
Wouldn't that be interesting? But
that would be very interesting.
Yeah. I think it would be something of a fight, and I don't mean of the nice kind. But, the one thing that you said in there that really caught my attention, and not that I expect it to happen either, but wouldn't it be interesting if there was a movement to basically throw all the incumbents out? Regardless of party, regardless of affiliation, just toss them all out. Everybody signs petitions or whatever saying, I commit to voting against all the incumbents on my ballot. Now, I don't think that's going to happen in any significant numbers, but that would be interesting. That would be a different kind of revolution. Whether or not we'd actually get anything that would be tied to the corporate system, I kind of doubt. But at least it'd be a change of blood, if nothing else.
Yeah, it's there is an organization that, throw the ones out, .com or something like that. they're not getting a lot of traction because most people don't pay attention to politics,
right?
And they voted Republican or Democrat all their lives, and when they get disgusted, then they re-register as independents and say, "Well, now I don't have to worry about that."
Yeah.
but the growth
changes in the election.
Yeah, but the growth of the independents is a sign that something is going to change. Some basic constituency of the past 50 years in terms of politics is going to happen, because people are no longer voting the party line automatically. They're actually looking at candidates and looking at issues, and then saying, I don't want to be associated with these Republicans, or I don't want to be associated with these Democrats. They're all a bunch of, you know, monkeys.
But the problem is you keep following that kind of logical, rational approach, you run out of candidates to vote for.
Well, in some states there is some revised election laws. For example, in California, you don't have to run in a party primary anymore. They eliminated party primaries a few years back. And as a consequence, what they have in the primary is candidates from almost every persuasion, Republicans, Democrats, Democrats, Democrat, Republican, Republican, Independent, Independent, Libertarian, Green, whatever, you know, a long list of candidates. And so you vote on those people in the primary, and the top two, whether they're of the same party or independents or whatever, go to the general election. So that kind of a system, and there's similar things, I think, in Louisiana and a few other states.
I think California has a system like that one.
Yeah, that's why I said I'm in California.
Yeah.
And that's,
oh, okay. Yeah.
That's they've done.
So it's the California.
Called the top two or whatever.
Right.
So it's there's all kinds of potential out there. I'm pleased that the libertarian ideas are being taken much more seriously than they were 10 years ago. I'm pleased that a lot of the independents have libertarian inclinations on the issues. And I think there could be a real political earthquake and realignment, not just on, you know, the major issues, but on issues like corporatism and war and surveillance and those kind of things. And we could end up with an entirely new, you know, political party, not the Tea Party, which is not a political party, but something along the lines of... I don't know what name to pin on it, but something that combines the best positions of the two parties into one party. From a libertarian perspective.
That's very, very optimistic. I give you a lot of credit for optimism on that one.
I'm not saying it's likely. I'm saying the trend is in that direction.
Okay. Well, I would agree that something's going to give somewhere.
Something's got to give.
I'd like to believe that it's going to be a positive result. I'm also a student of history, unfortunately. But
well, I mean, the founding fathers didn't want political parties. So maybe the whole concept of political party will disappear.
Well,
maybe
let's be precise. Certain founding fathers didn't want political parties. Other founding fathers very definitely wanted political parties. Factionalism was a big part of what a lot of them had in mind. I think it's fair to say, for instance, that Hamilton, you know, he was pretty much jostling for parties, particularly that would support the idea of a strong executive. And that was a big part of what he was trying to do. Jefferson, on the other hand, Jefferson wasn't real crazy about parties.
Yeah, so, well, my count of the so-called founders, which is kind of a vague category, was that most of them didn't like political parties. They didn't like partisan politics and using the government for special interest gains. And although I agree, Hamilton did. He had friends. He wanted to, you know, control the government in order to benefit his friends. And that's basically what we've had for the past 200 years plus.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think that the idea of special interests, of bailouts, of subsidies, of, you know, tax benefits, of all kinds of havens, of captured portions of the U.S. government, like the Defense Department is controlled basically by the industrial complex of a dozen different companies. I think that could very easily go away.
Wow, now that's got to be your most optimistic statement so far. Go away?
I
would be celebrating in the streets, don't get me wrong. I'd be one of the ones out there waving the banner around, but
depends.
I don't know.
it depends upon the people. It depends upon the people, you know, actually thinking about the issues and actually, you know, picking candidates who aren't just, you know, don't wear the same label as they do, but have positions on the issue and have positions on corporatism and have positions on surveillance and war and all these other things. And that will encourage candidates to run who have those positions and maybe not win the first time around, but, you know, a few elections down the road, I think we could have a very, very large change in the Congress and in the political atmosphere.
Well, I will say this much, and we're only down to a minute, so I guess I have to keep it kind of short. But I think that a lot of it has to do with how the people who speak out frame what they're speaking out about. So if people choose to speak out against war, I would recommend that they choose to speak out in favor of peace instead. If they're choosing to speak out against, you know, poverty, I would recommend they speak out in favor of prosperity instead. In other words, emphasize the positives rather than the negatives. Because the sad fact is, every time we emphasize negatives, we tend to get more of the negatives. And that's just like a trend that's been going on for years and years and years. So if we're going to break that trend, let's at least try to do it with some positive messages instead. How's that?
Yeah, well, it possibly encouraging was that the reason why Bratt beat Cantor was because Cantor spent $5 million on negative ads. And those negative ads increased Bratt's visibility and favorability because of what they were criticizing him for. So you may see this coming year that people, candidates are a little more positive than negative ads.
Do you have any sense of what Bratt's ads were? Because I had no idea what his ad campaign was. I know he had like a $100,000 budget, which isn't very large. But do you have any idea of what his advertising said?
From what I've read, zero. He spent all of his money on staff and traveling.
Well, that's not reassuring, but at least it wasn't negative.
But, you know, it's a grassroots campaign. So, you know, if people see a grassroots campaign, don't automatically slough them off as losers. There's an opportunity to get involved and engaged and encourage them, and they might win.
Well, on that happy note, let's draw a close, and we'll pick it up next week. Bill, it's been a pleasure as usual.
You.
We'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Possibilities. Good night, everybody. Crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time.